Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 20. And this is with Greg Johnson, John Morgan, and Michael Polignano of Countercurrents. Hello, everyone.
Hello,
Hello.
hosts. It's nice to be here.
Right. So, I suppose the important thing to talk about is the transition that seems to be taking place in the movement just now. But I guess before we get to that, it would be worth talking about the year that has passed, because it's been a hell of a year, has it not?
Yeah, it's been a terrible year for me. How about you, John?
Yeah, I would have to say, 2016 was sort of like the high, and then like 2017 ended up being like the hangover afterwards. It's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think our expectations were really high, and at least as far as I'm concerned, I feel like there was a lot of squandered opportunity. But I'm still confident, and I'm still persisting. So, I think everybody should. But yeah, there's certainly been a lot to a lot of challenges this year.
Well, I think it's been a year of real growth and becoming, and definitely challenges as well. But I think objectively, with all the fuck ups that happened this year, despite all that, I do think that we're objectively in a better position now than we were a year ago, and incredibly better than 2 years ago. So that's very encouraging.
Well, that's the thing. As I've said several times in this series, there have been, a lot of hits this year, in the negative sense of the word, and yet the movement has grown. And I'm interested in what you just said, Michael, about how compare the movement 2 years ago. How do you mean when you say that we're much better off now than we were then? And then talk about 2 years ago, and then 1 year ago, and then now. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on that. And John and Greg can chime in if you have ideas.
Well, 2 years ago, obviously, there was everything. It seemed like, as far as the mainstreaming of our ideas is concerned, there was, Trump just getting started with this election campaign, which really had the effect of bringing a whole lot of people out of the woodwork who have been silent, or who have just been involved in online activism. And these people decided to start coming to Trump events, and there was a lot of networking and real life contacts that got started that way. And that has been tremendously beneficial. It's also, you've had so many more YouTube channels getting started on this
Just
past.
before you get to that, before you get to that, when you say that lots of people came out of the woodwork because of Trump,
Right.
now the mainstream media would say that these are closet racists or people getting into what they call racism. Would you say that's, well, I mean, if we in-group preference, white nationalism, whatever, would you say that is accurate? That the people who were awakened by Trump were awakened to white nationalism or to something short of that?
I think if people have been weighing these ideas for a long time in their head, in the privacy of their own mind, I think we do have a similar situation to what was occurring during the fall of communism, where people are aware of racial differences, they're aware of differing crime statistics, and aware of, Black Lives Matter and all these social movements, and the identity politics that have been going on. And I think that Trump was able to, give people. I think that everybody who's associated and who came out of the woodwork, so to speak, and has gotten involved, probably is more, racially aware than they're willing to let on in public. But I think if you scratch under the surface, you will find that there are, people who you know, are definitely aware and wanting to finally express frustrations that have been growing, resentments that have been growing for a long time.
Okay, so if we said that started 2 years ago, then compare that with a year ago.
Well, a year ago, we had, of course, Trump's election, which was a huge victory for us. And during this time, what I saw the effectiveness of, which had never really been made that clear to me, is I saw just how effective some of this online, all the meme magic and the Twitter, what's the word I'm looking for here?
The tweeting.
I've never really been into trolling. It's not my thing. Partly because I've been, active under my own name since a very long time, ever since I was a university student. I basically was outed as a racist then. Actually, I outed myself. And so it's been a little difficult for me. I see things a little differently because of that. My attitude towards a lot of the anonymous trolling was always very negative, because I thought that it's something that indicates a lack of maturity, a lack of seriousness, a lack of authenticity, and it just comes down to bullying. And so I was never really keen on, programs like The Daily Show or, The Daily Stormer, all of this. But, it grew on me after I saw how effective it has been in influencing people. I think that
hold on. What would John and Greg say about that? Because there is an ongoing uncertainty as to the extent to which memeing and the trolling had an effect on the election. Do either of you have anything to say about that?
Well, I think that it did have an effect, but not as much as some people think. I mean, I've heard some people in our circle say that, basically the alt-right won the election for Trump. And I acknowledge that it was a factor, but I really think if you look at America as a whole, there was a whole lot of other factors feeding into it. I mean, the intense dislike people had of the Clintons, the frustration with the legacy of the Obama era. I mean, there were a lot of things feeding into it. The alt-right was definitely one of them. But I question whether I got the feeling after the election that some people in our circles thought that all the people who voted for Trump did so because they were all in agreement with the alt-right. And, earlier this year, I went back to where I used to live, which was in Michigan in the U.S., which, of course, is one of the states that flipped for Trump last year. And I was talking to people, who were just, ordinary farmers, working class people in Michigan. And when I would mention the alt-right, most of them had never heard of it. Many of them had never heard of Spencer, or even in some cases, Steve Bannon, although of course, more people had heard of him. And I still found that
The king of the alt-right, Milo Yiannopoulos, had they heard of him?
I didn't ask in that case, cause he was already, he'd already kind of been discredited by that point. So I didn't bring that up, but I felt like I remember talking to one guy who's the father of a friend of mine. He's very conservative, but in a very typical American way. And, he still thinks the problem was, big government. And, when I brought up immigration, he said, well, yeah, the problem with Muslims is that they don't integrate well in America. And I mean, that's a good starting point, but if people are truly red-pilled in the sense that we mean it,
you know, on the more radical right, if we want to call it that, you know, it means that you understand that there's, you know, there's something wrong with immigration from other cultures generally. It's not just Muslims. It's anybody from a culture that's foreign to Western civilization when they come in large numbers. I mean, that's the issue. But these people still haven't reached that point yet, which suggests to me, you know, I think we could get there, but it means we still have a lot of work to do. Now, when we were talking earlier, and I referred to this past year as sort of the hangover after the euphoria of Trump's victory, you know, I felt like there was really a moment when we could seize it and really sort of communicate with mainstream America, offer them something that they weren't otherwise getting. And unfortunately, because of, you know, events like Charlottesville and a lot of the other things that went down this year, I feel like that moment's kind of been squandered now. You know, I've talked about this on some of the Countercurrents podcasts, but I really think the alt-right as a brand is kind of tarnished now in the eyes of mainstream Americans anyway. And ultimately, I mean, we don't want to be a subculture. We want to be something that mainstream Americans can relate to and identify with and are willing to learn from and listen to. And I feel like we've not Countercurrents specifically, but the movement as a whole has really been falling short on that this year.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. Generally, I agree with John. Generally speaking, I think the memeing and trolling and so forth were somewhat useful. Things like the Cuckservative meme were very useful. And what I saw was the beginning of people in our milieu being able to drive the news cycle, influence the parameters of debate and so forth. So that was a breakthrough for us. That was very important. I do think that people overestimated this. I think people got really giddy and grandiose and out of touch with reality at a certain point, and thought that, yeah, we were...
And there's a real danger there, because I agree with John that the alt-right did not meme Trump into the White House.
I agree,
too. I know that, yeah, that there is a need to pep... No pun intended. There's a need to pep ourselves up. I understand that. But I think there's a huge danger in saying something like that, proclaiming something like that, grandiose. And then, well, then what do you do next?
Well, that's what the whole meme magic thing is about, right? A lot of it is about the idea that you can bullshit things into reality. And a lot of it comes out of this manospherian fake it till you make it, you know, swagger and posture, because a lot of people in our movement actually think there's nothing more to politics than what they learned about picking up chicks, right? As if the whole world consisted of drunk girls in bars, and you know, there was nothing more to politics than that. And there's a lot more to it than that. You need to build trust amongst people. You need to craft messages, and just swagger and big talk and fakery, I think, will burn through your credibility really, really fast. And I think the great thing that we have on our side is truth and the credibility that we gain from speaking uncomfortable truths. And if we burn through that credibility by supporting lies and shilling and grandiose claims that don't come through, we're fools. We're destroying our greatest capital resource and for nothing. So I do think that we have to rein in the tendency for premature political populism, and also the tendency for this kind of manospherian, Nietzschean, fake it till you make it mentality, which I think is harmful. And usually,
yeah, I think it's harmful as well. I mean, yeah. Because, you know, to say that, you know, we memed Trump into the White House or whatever. That is, I think, it's based on, it's delusion. It's hubris. And hubris leads to miscalculation, which leads to disappointment, which leads possibly to despair. And nemesis. I think that, to be honest,
hubris invites nemesis. And
yes, indeed. And yeah. I think that's maybe what we've seen to some extent. That's what we've seen play out in 2017. It's like, well, if we did that, then why aren't we being effectual now? And the truth is that we didn't do that. And
yeah, we didn't. We have to recognize that what's creating the increase in interest in our movement are objective factors that are baked in to the multicultural project, to the immigration project. That's what's driving consciousness in our direction. And we're over here memeing and tweeting and waving our hands around. And we think that because these things are happening at the same time as the stuff we're doing, that somehow we're causing it to happen. And it's just an illusion. We are in a position to capture some of those energies and shape some of that consciousness. Yeah, when people start waking up to the problems of multiculturalism, they will come to our websites. And so far, we haven't been all that great, I think, in formulating something that captures the imaginations of millions of people who are now taking a look at what we have to say and then translating that changed consciousness into any kind of political change. We haven't been doing a very good job of that. Yet, I think a lot of us think that we are causing this. We're not causing this. We're benefiting from underlying processes that are baked into multiculturalism, which means that the mistakes that we make are not catastrophic either, right? If we're not causing our people to wake up, then the mistakes that we make are not going to make them go back to sleep. We're going to have to drop the mistakes, learn from them, put them behind us, and figure out new things. I think that's what we need to do in 2018. 2017 was a year where we tried to capitalize on Trump, basically. And we really didn't do a very good job. 2017 brought us Donald Trump and it brought us Brexit. And those are great things to capitalize on. In 2017, we didn't really do much to capitalize on them. In fact, we made a lot of mistakes. We, I think, lost a lot of institutions that provided value. And instead, we took a lot of energy and social capital and financial capital, and we burned them up in the potlatch at Charlottesville and at various other IRL events that did not go very well. And so at the end of 2016, for instance, just to speak of one sphere, which is Richard Spencer's operation, there was an MPI conference that was the biggest ever, and there was a Radix journal going. In 2017, we got altright.com, and we got a series of rallies and things like that. Radix journal is gone. NPI's conference basically canceled halfway through because the venue shut down, and it was only a small gathering of maybe 60 people, not the 300 plus people who were at the previous one or 200 plus people, however it was. So a lot of things that were producing value in 2016 didn't end up producing value in 2017 because we got distracted with other stuff that didn't work. And I think
I believe that Radix Journal is now back up.
I hope it comes back. I mean, it wasn't all that fabulous, but they did produce some good stuff. And it was certainly head and shoulders and leagues and infinities of space and time above altright.com, which is really trash. So, yeah, that's a positive sign. So I do believe that in 2018, there's going to be some rethinking of what our actual strengths are. And I believe that we have to have a serious debate about whether public rallies are a good idea, period. I do think that some public activism on the identitarian model is very valid. And I think that that's the direction that IRL groups should go towards. However, rallies that you announce in advance where you go out and battle Antifa and police and things like that, That's not a good idea. That's not a good use of our time and resources, and I hope we don't do that. Our great strength is metapolitical rather than activist rallying. And I think that we lost some metapolitical platforms like Radix Journal and the MPI conference in 2017 in order to go all in with rallies and campus speeches, which aren't very good uses of time and money and actually produce terrible, catastrophic effects in terms of movement capital in 2017, the deplatforming wave and things like that after Charlottesville hurt a lot of us.
Oh yeah, that was terrible. What I would say about I think that the Charlottesville rally was not good. I don't think it worked out. In terms of the campus, whatever campus visits, I think that Spencer's one at Texas A&M was a great success. I think that the latter one, I forgot where it was now, was it Florida? I don't think that worked out well. But of course, the landscape has changed. Antifa are, they're in a different, completely different mood from the one they were in this time last year. I mean, they have mobilized in a way that they can sour things, you know?
Right. There was Texas A&M, then there was Auburn, which I didn't think was very good. And then there was the Florida thing, which was, I think, pretty much a disaster. They were just shut down. So, yeah, I think in 2018, we need to go back to our strengths, which are getting ideas and memes out there and changing people's minds, figuring out ways of shaping consciousness. We're not ready for mass movements. We're not ready for rallies yet. We're not ready for that kind of political prime time. And we have such limited capital, both in terms of money and in terms of social capital, people, networks and things like that. And a lot of that was destroyed in 2017, and it needs to be rebuilt in 2018. And then we need to, I think, retrench and focus on the things where we get the greatest bang for our buck. And that really is communicating through the internet, primarily through YouTube and through podcasting and everything else, websites, webzines, publishing books, and so forth. That's our strength. And I think that in 2018, we need to go back to our strength. And we need to fight on the grounds where we have the advantage. The establishment has all the money in the world. They have all the police. They have the whole establishment, the whole political establishment dance to their tune. We can't challenge them in the political realm yet. But they lack the truth, and they lack credibility. They lack honesty. And that's where we have the advantage. So we need to fight on grounds that are advantageous to us rather than fight on grounds that are advantageous to our enemies and where we can only lose. I think in 2017, we fought battles that we couldn't possibly win and wasted a great deal of capital. In 2018, we need to refocus on the battles that we can win, because you can't be a leader if you keep failing over and over again.
There's one other thing I think that we have, which the establishment doesn't have, and that is cultural honesty, or you might call it truth. But I mean, specifically with reference to culture, I think that, you know, in 2015 and 16, well, especially 2015, before the Trump thing really started, the alt-right as an online space was largely inhabited by people talking about culture, whether it was music or, you know, film reviews, things like that, especially on the blogs, but also on the podcasts, less so on YouTube, because there really wasn't much alt-right stuff on YouTube in 2015. But anyway, we were talking about culture, and we were presenting a new and original perspective on these things, film, music, books, literature. And it was one that chimed with the times and was fresh and honest. And then we lost that. You know, I think in a way the arrival of Trump meant that we all, and Brexit actually, meant that we switched from that to a much more political mode. And then we continued that in 2017 with the rallies and things like that. When really we should have gone back to what we were doing in the first place, which was memeing, yes, and cultural commentary. because, and I don't mean that, so that sounds quite dry when I say it like that, but I mean, it's not dry, because this is the, as everyone says, politics is downstream of culture. And this is where we have an advantage, because what do the left have in this day and age in terms of cultural commentary? They've got absolutely nothing, because they are the establishment and they can't critique themselves. So this is what we should be attacking. This is, and I don't even mean attacking in a militaristic sense. This is what we should be commenting upon and dissecting. Well, we have an advantage.
I was just going to say that, I mean, for me, I've been involved with this stuff now. Well, I've been interested in these sorts of ideas for going on 20 years now, but it's about 10 years ago since I first started to get active with publishing and so forth. And when we were gestating the idea of what eventually became the alt-right, I mean, the goals that we had were to overcome the legacy of groups like the Klan and neo-Nazis. And also it was to overcome the legacy of conservatism and so forth, what we would now call cuckservatism. And unfortunately this year, I think what's happened is that, now everybody associates the alt-right with neo-Nazism and the Klan again. And when I go to a lot of the alt-right websites, a lot of people are talking about what the Republicans are doing after years where we were trying to convince people that, not to worry about mainstream politics in America. We're kind of back into getting bogged down in that stuff, when the fact is that we can't influence it anyway. I mean, I haven't completely given up on Trump. I mean, every time I think to myself that, okay, that this is it, that was the last straw, I can't stand by him anymore, he always does something that I like that makes me think, okay, I'll give him a few more months. I'm not, but that's going to happen regardless. And our task should be, to call for something more radical. And when I say radical, I mean radical in terms of ideas, not radical and, we're the baddest and the most violent and whatever. I mean, radical ideas. That's really our role, is to propose this alternative way of conceiving of society. And we should do that rather than, reusing symbols and rhetoric from the 1930s and talking about what the Republicans are doing.
Yeah. I mean, that actually drags us down into the swamp. I shouldn't use that word, but it drags us down into the quagmire of boring political commentary.
Yes.
And, and at that point you may as well just be a mainstream publication. Right. It's far more interesting to talk about culture and society in the abstract, in the macro, than to get, bogged down in whatever's going on in the White House or 10 Downing Street in this particular week, because in the end, it's always going to be the same old drivel anyway. Even with Trump in the White House, it's still the same, wheeling and dealing and compromises that don't actually go anywhere. They certainly don't lead to the kind of radical societal change that we're after.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say that we should never discuss what's going on in mainstream politics, but I don't think it should be a focus of what we're doing, and we certainly shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking that we can influence it. At least not at this stage.
Of course. Yeah, indeed.
Well,
Michael, you wanted to say something?
Yes. I was going to say, with the as far as cultural commentary and memeing that you mentioned earlier, Woz, I think those are definitely ways that we can get there are ways that we can get our message out there to the public more effectively than what we've been doing in the past, which is great. It's having online journals like Countercurrents and like Radix, get movie reviews and cultural commentary is excellent. But I think the more that happens through alternative means, whether it's on YouTube video, talking about it in this sort of way, or doing kind of cultural hijacking along the lines of what the European identitarians have done, would be great. Which is not mass rallies and stuff like that, but for instance, at the end of last year, Martin Selner had a great idea. He put forth on his YouTube channel about doing this, getting a banner getting a group together in Atlanta to go to the CNN headquarters and putting a banner up in front of the on this ledge that says "Home of Fake News." And there's a way to do that just based on the way the building is set up. But it was just an idea he put forward. But I thought it was a really great one. Whenever anything in the current events happens that has cultural relevance, you know, we need to be the ones who are among the first to comment on it in a really effective and hard-hitting way.
Yeah, and I think that it would be good if there were more alt-right channels specifically dedicated to that. I mean, for my own part, I don't think I'm good at those sorts of things. Like, some event happens, and then people say, "When are you going to make a video? You're going to make a video about this." And I'm not good at that. So I wish that there were other alt-right channels that were specifically tailored, well, specifically made by people who are good at doing that, because I know that they exist. It's just that they use other platforms instead of YouTube. God knows why. You know, it's exasperating, because YouTube is where you find the public, or where the public find you, rather. As long as you're not banned.
Yes, well, it's encouraging to see all the multitude of YouTube channels that have been coming about in the past year.
Yes, indeed. The alt-right on YouTube has really exploded in 2017. As I said in a previous Hangout, I think last millennial, I had something like 26 Hangouts, and this time it's 59.
Wow.
And there could have been more. You know, there could have been more. I mean, there are people last year, I don't know, probably at least half of them last year, are still going, but they're not appearing this year, because I had to make room for the new ones, you know? So it's, you know, there you go. You know, that's an indication of the growth in the alt-right just in the last 12 months. And that's pretty incredible, especially when you consider what we've been up against, you know, the setbacks that we've had. And this really gives me cause for optimism, because, you know, God knows it can be demoralizing. But you have to remember, you have to bear in mind that we just are growing. Even if you can't explain why we're growing, we just are growing.
Right,
and that's great.
Yeah, that's a great thing. In terms of the morale issue, I wrote a piece recently that's called "Don't Let the Bastards Get You Down." It's at Countercurrents on the front page, and there's actually an audio version of it for the podcast people, the pod people. And it's ostensibly about the recent attacks against Tara McCarthy and Lauren Southern and other women in the alt-right. But the reasons I give for not leaving the movement because of personal attacks, of course, apply to everybody, because everybody has doubts from time to time, I think, when things get ugly. And there is a lot of ugliness, just sort of interpersonal ugliness within the movement, and also ugliness from outside directed at people in it. And a lot of people, normally constituted people, will have doubts and think about giving up. And I rehearse a number of arguments for why we shouldn't give up. And I do think that beyond those arguments, there are also just objective reasons for optimism that I don't deal with in that essay, and that I will deal with in another essay. I think we need sort of primers, things to remind ourselves of why we're doing this and why there's reason to believe that there will be success. And the biggest reason for me is that nature is on our side. The things that we want are natural, normal, and right, and they were the common sense of politics throughout most of history in every functional society. We're not monsters, right? We're ahead of the curve. What's happened here is, well, we've lost a lot of common sense. A lot of normal thinking has been basically replaced by a fake consensus that is totally disconnected with reality. But nature is on our side, because this fake consensus cannot survive the tests of political reality, and we're seeing that happening. So that is the thing that is most, I think, reason for hope. And beyond that, I think that we are getting better and better people in this movement, and we're going to figure out how to capture the energies, the consciousness that's being raised by the problems of multiculturalism, and channel it towards real political change. We're getting better and better people all the time, and I'm confident that we're going to figure it out. Maybe 2018 will be the year where that formula finally gels, right? 2017 has been a year of mistakes, but if we can learn from those mistakes, then it's not such a bad year. One of the great things I think that will happen in 2018 is we're going to move forward on creating our own electronic ethnostate, trying to harden our movement against the kind of things that were done to us after Charlottesville, the deplatforming, the seizure of domain registration or domain names, that kind of stuff. That was stuff that we knew was theoretically possible, although I don't think any of us anticipated that somebody would simply take the Daily Stormer's domain registration away from them or domain name away from them. That was shocking even to the most jaded and cynical among us. But we were thinking that this would have to happen, and now it's going to happen. So things like that are moving forward. These things are happening quietly behind the scenes, but when they're rolled out, and they will come out in 2018, that I think is going to be a game-changing thing. We're going to be a lot harder and a lot less vulnerable than we were in 2017. So that's room for optimism too. Just one more thing. Objectively, things are going pretty well for Countercurrents. Our traffic is doing well. We brought out many more books in 2017 than we did in 2016. Book sales are doing really quite well. Donations are coming in. Objectively, things are going pretty well, but still there's something about this year that makes me look upon it with a jaundiced eye. And I think one of the things that has been a black pill is after Charlottesville, a lot of people just went dark in my social media sphere. They decided for whatever reasons that the movement was not the thing for them right now, and they just went silent. A lot of people have taken a step back, and they haven't become leftists or conservatives. They haven't changed their views. Nobody who comes to our views rationally ever leaves them rationally. So what's going on is they're hanging back and they're waiting for some new formulation, some new movement, some new way of taking the next step forward. And when that thing appears, I think a lot of these people will come back with renewed enthusiasm. So there's a lot to look forward to in 2018.
I'll just say, you know, related to the idea of rallies and so forth, I think we will get to the point that we can move into that mode once we've accomplished more of the cultural metapolitical preparation. But I think, you know, I know that some of the people who went into Charlottesville went in with good intentions and didn't anticipate what the fallout from it would be. But I think their mistake was thinking that we were further along in the process than we actually are. And there's still a lot of preparatory work that we need to do. Like you said before, Woz, about, you know, the cultural work, you know, that, you know, getting the ideas out there, finding ways to communicate to people who aren't already in the movement that are appealing, that won't alienate them by seeming strange or subcultural or, you know, otherwise off-putting. So I think that's what we need to do. And perhaps like Greg said, you know, we just need to ditch the existing labels and come up with something new and, you know, start moving in that direction and not going for premature action.
I think it's definitely true that we overestimated our power and our resiliency. But however, one thing I wouldn't see there is a sense that the alt-right as a singular thing is now, well, as a brand, let's put it that way, the alt-right as a brand has now outlived its usefulness. But the thing is, this is something that you can overanalyze, because it's a fact that there is a tremendous amount of energy in the alt-right. There's a tremendous amount of momentum. It is a household name, household term, and there are people who are gravitating towards it. And even with the shortcomings, even with the more unpleasant connotations that the media have applied to it, a large well, there are large numbers of new people coming from the public into it. So I wouldn't want to lose that momentum. You know, if we're going to move on from that term, there is a danger that by doing so, we lose our solidarity, our collective energy. Let's put it that way. That's a problem, and I have no idea. That might be something that just sorts itself out as people make their own individual decisions. I'm not sure you could actually, you know, orchestrate it one way or the other anyway.
Yes, I think definitely our strongest asset is that, as Greg mentioned, truth is on our side, and that once people are red-pilled and go through all the arguments and all the logic of it, they come to our way of thinking, they really don't go back to their former way of thinking. If they're people, you know, who are fundamentally moved by and act based on reason and logic, you know, that's, you know, only perhaps about 5 to 10% of the population. There are plenty of people who are affected by other pressures, by, you know, what other people think, and, you know, more just other motives. But there is a free thinking, independent minded, independent percentage of the population that is absolutely essential. And I think we're more and more of that percentage is coming around to our way of thinking. The challenge now, however, is that, you know, socially, whether our movement can, you know, as you guys were saying, not be seen and perceived as something that's marginal, as something that's motivated by hatred, rather than, you know, by out of love for our people.
That's an important point.
Yeah. But yeah, when we started Countercurrents, Greg actually said that something like it used the idea of Aristotle's of being this website where our ideas would be completely radical, and yet, you know, and uncompromising, grounded in reality, and not really, you know, move too much based on the opinions of other people. So I think we need to continue with that. But I do think, you know, the danger in what's going on with the deplatforming, you know, with this upcoming Twitter ban that's going to take effect on the 18th, and, you know, with the development of the alt tech, is that, you know, we can't allow that to be, you know, be something that marginalizes us and pushes us off into this dark corner of the internet that nobody goes to. You know, we can't just be a network of
oh, exactly. Know, we don't yeah. want to, you know, ghettoize ourselves like that. Exactly. That's ridiculous. And as someone pointed out in the chat, again, the difficulty, the stupidity, the folly of abandoning the alt-right label is that, in effect, you would have to be starting a new movement from nothing. Because even though it is just a label, it is a label that unifies. And so if you don't have that collective name anymore, you're, you know, what do you do?
You call yourself be a white nationalist. I mean, for me, the movement that I've been involved in has always been white nationalism, which I define as advocacy of independent homelands for all white peoples. And that's a more substantive statement of what we want. It's a more honest and substantive statement of what we want. The alt-right was useful because it was vague enough that a lot of people who wanted to dip their toes into more radical ideas but have plausible deniability and be able to scuttle back towards the center if their mom looked over their shoulder and saw what they were looking at on their computer screens, that was a useful thing. And I do think we need something similar to that to play
the... Yeah, but white nationalism, I agree, but white nationalist is not that thing, is it?
No, white nationalism isn't that thing. And yet, there could be something else to do to perform that function, and there really needs to be something else to perform that function, because one of the things that started late in 2016 was a concerted effort to basically identify the alt-right with white nationalism and even neo-Nazism, right? That was one of the things that Andrew Anglin was very much concerned to do, predominantly, I think, just because the brand was so hot, he wanted it to become his brand. And after Hailgate, I think that that link was really strongly established. And that's when a lot of the alt-right people said, hey, this is not something we want to be involved in. And so there was a polarization, and a lot of people left. And I think that it no longer really performs the function of the kind of vague umbrella term that offers some plausible deniability that allows people to interface with us without, it's a kind of try before you buy thing. It's like the changing room at the store, right? Or it's like letting people test drive a car. They can get involved in this without feeling obligated yet. And I think that's an important space that needs to be provided. I just don't think that it is going to be able to be provided or is being provided by the alt-right brand anymore.
What I would say is this thing about Hailgate is that we can talk about the unfairness of it. It's like a small bunch of people in the audience, like four people, but it's still a fact that it enabled the mainstream media to associate the alt-right with neo-Nazism, which in turn is just riddled with connotations that have been built up over the last 70 years. But now the good thing about Hailgate was that it, by polarizing people, it drove the alt-right cucks away. The ones who had no, who were allergic to race and so on, it got rid of them. Milo, PJW, and so on. And that was good, because we wanted rid of them. They were trying to co-opt the label. But on the other hand, as you said, it did allow the extreme elements to basically take the label for themselves and now dominate it in a way that they did not in 2016. So I don't like that situation. And it is, as you say, well, polarized.
Yeah, and honestly, I was never that worried about Milo and PJW and people like that for this simple reason. And this goes back to the active trolling directed at people like Lauren Southern. You can't convert people who already agree with you, which means that all potential converts come from people who don't yet agree with you. And if people are listening to Milo and listening to us, well, that's fine. I want ways of encountering and opening minds that don't already agree with us, because that's sort of the bleeding edge on which our movement grows. And before that polarization, a lot of these people were, whether they were intended to or not, they were gathering audiences that we could poach easily over to our position. And since then, there's been a hardening of the boundaries. And now you have figures on the alt-right, for instance, Gavin McGinnis, whose entire mission seems to be to draw the line and say, you can't go past this line. You know, here be dragons. You can't do this. Before that, he wasn't doing that, and now he is. So the boundaries have hardened, and I. Think
but at the same, by off. The same token, yeah. But by the same token, people have jumped ship from the alt-right to ethno-nationalism.
Oh yeah, and I think, but they would have done that. Yeah. They would have done that if the boundaries hadn't hardened too. In fact, I think more people would have come over if the thing had not been so factionalized. Because look. I look at this kind of civic nationalism, which is the default position of the alt-right people, as an unstable compromise. It doesn't survive a good 15 minutes of critique when you get right down to it. Maybe I need to record a 15-minute critique of it and just get that out there. It doesn't stand up to that kind of critique. And that means that it's child's play for us to bring these people over to our side. One thing that happened early this year that caused my eyes to like come out on stalks, like in a cartoon, you know, my eyes came bugging out. Milo linked something written by Spencer Quinn. And this was like the last day of February in 2017. He linked an article by Spencer Quinn. And within like 2 hours, we had 12,000 or more visits to that article. And the next day, we had another 12,000 visits. So it was like the number one article on our website for 2 months running, because of one link by Milo on Facebook. That blew my mind. And that made me realize the people on the Alt-Light have enormous audiences. And we want those audiences. I want the 400K people who subscribe to Lauren Southern's channel on YouTube, for instance, to watch her video on the Identity Europa, 365,000 or how many times it's been watched. Identitarianism. I want that to happen. And so if we have a less polarized and more productive relationship with some of these alt-light figures, that is something that can happen. They can send us a lot of people. And when some of those people get a taste of the stuff that we're saying, they're going to stick around. And so I would love to have in 2018 a much more amicable relationship with these alt-light people than has existed in 2017. And I hope that's something that can happen, because I'm serious about getting our message out there. And if these people are not acting as active agents of active gatekeepers, right, against us, but rather just as a gateway to us, then that's good. And I think after Hailgate, they went from gateways to gatekeepers. And this is especially true with somebody like McGinnis, who I think is a despicable man. I've tried to be as nice to him. I've met him a number of times and things like that. I've tried to be nice to him. But at this point, he just seems like he's all wound up to be our enemy. And at that point, I have to be his enemy back. And I don't want that. I don't want to be in that position. So anyway, I'm hoping. And one of the reasons why I got so bloody irritated with this trolling directed at Tara and Lauren and all these other women is that some of the trolling, I mean, underlying it is a great deal of misogyny and also just a desire to sow division in the cause. I do believe that that's the goal, to create division and to express certain hateful attitudes towards women out of sheer emotional self-indulgence. And that's the thing that I hate about the troll culture. Basically, these people think that politics is just a matter of emotional self-indulgence, and so they will do all kinds of things that are destructive to our cause because, hey, it feels good, and there's an internet lynch mob doing it, so why not join in, right? But when they come up with arguments or pretexts for doing this, they'll say, well, Lauren Southern is a civic nationalist, and it's like, yeah, so what? I don't care about that. Lauren Southern may not be 100% on board with what I believe, but if there are lines of communication between the two of us and she's doing videos like the one she did on Generation Identity, she is actually helping ethnic nationalism more than I can, even though she doesn't believe in it. And we need to grow yeah. up. We need to fucking grow up, people. She can do more for ethno-nationalism than I can, and she doesn't even believe it. And we're looking gift horses like that in the mouth. You know, I was just thinking today as I was making a cup of tea, I thought, yeah, you know, if you really want to bully side and troll female journalists, and if you're an ultra-right-wing shitlord, why not go after Rachel Maddow or some awful person like that? Why not go after people like that? They're girls too. They're fragile. they might break. They might be bully-sided into suicide, like that porn star was recently. And there were people who were clucking about that and thinking Tara McCarthy's next, right? These people are evil.
That was disgusting. That was just disgusting.
Yeah, these people are evil, and they're idle. And the thing is that why aren't they attacking mainstream leftist female journalists? Why are they attacking people who are sort of on our side, and in fact are a valuable bridge between what we're doing and stuff that's more mainstream? We want more bridges to the mainstream. We want more lines of influence extending outwards so we can pull on those lines of influence and reel people in. So,
and also not everybody is ready for the whole red pill all at once. I mean,
I've
always seen the alt-light as like an intermediary stage. But we should be going into conflict with them just because, you know, we have disagreements on things. I mean,
right.
We probably all had sort of an alt-light perspective at one point in our past.
That's another thing we need to recognize. There are a lot of people who are ranting and raving and treating these people like vile heretics that need to be burned at the stake, who a year before were parroting the same views. And my response to that is, come on, folks, have a little compassion. There was a time in your life when you believed the stuff that you are calling for blood for when other people state them. That's a weird attitude. You should have a little bit more compassion. You should be a little bit less self-righteous. And if you try and affect that attitude, just try it on for a minute, right? Ask yourself how you would have responded if somebody had come at the earlier you with the kind of rhetoric that you're pounding these people with today. Obviously, you wouldn't be persuaded by that. Most people are not persuaded by bullying.
No, and another point of this is, and another point here is that there are people are in the chat saying that Lauren Southern is not useful to us because she's a coal burner. Those two things do not, the second clause does not justify the first one. She could still be useful to, she can and is still useful to us, even if she is a coal burner.
Now, even if she were married to a black man. Well, yeah. How about John Derbyshire? John Derbyshire is married to a Chinese woman. John Derbyshire, I hate to say it, but it's true. He puts out a lot of very useful material and has built a large audience. And not only has he done that, but as a sign that his heart is in the right place, he acts as a gateway rather than a gatekeeper. He has a large audience of people that he has brought further to the right on these issues than even himself. Then even he can really occupy, given the fact that he's married to a Chinese woman and has two mixed race kids. So I have to give him credit for that. If Lauren Southern were coal black herself and were an advocate for white interests, she could still do quite a lot. So if we can admit the possibility that there are people who are not white and are still white allies of white people and advocates of white people, I mean, I'm an ally and an advocate for the survival of tigers, but I'm not a tiger, right? Imagine the dwindling tiger population, if they could speak, looking at all these humans who are advocating for them and saying, we don't need no stinking human advocates. Humans are the problem here, right? That'd be foolish, right? Well, If we could admit that it's a possibility that there are non-whites who are on our side, why can't we admit the possibility that there are people who have, given the multi-culti nature of the society we live in and the constant barrage of pro-race mixing propaganda, why can't we admit the possibility that people who have succumbed to that, and let's not be hypocritical, there are quite a lot of people who have, the people who have succumbed to that can't still believe the things that we believe and actually make positive contributions to our cause.
And are doing so. It's not even hypothetical.
Yeah, exactly. But if you can admit that it's at least conceivable, then we can point to examples. And Derbyshire is an example. And Derbyshire has done far worse than worse in the sense of miscegenation than Lauren Southern. I mean, people are saying she's a coal burner, a miscegenator. I think we're presuming too much.
By the way,
we're presuming too much. She might have had a couple of chaste dates with somebody who was half black or something when she was 16 or 20. I don't know. We're assuming quite a lot of stuff that's not in evidence. And even if the worst case scenario were true, it doesn't make it impossible for her to be genuinely helpful to us. And she really is genuinely helpful to us.
Her videos get 200,000 views. I mean, this is what I just can't believe the naivety of people who think, yeah, let's shoot ourselves in the foot for the sake of a principle. And then they'll go on. And after all, we can't use sex to sell something, to sell an idea. That would be, what would that be? Would that be immoral?
That would be degenerate and unprincipled. Yeah, these are the kind of people who think that all TV ads for cars should just give information about gas mileage and stuff like that, just objective data, right? I mean, it's, but the fact is that the ad, that the cars with the prettiest girls in the ads, or the cars that look the best, often outsell the ones with the best gas mileage. Go figure. It's just one of the injustices of the world.
Exactly. And of course, people will say, but this is not applicable because that's a product and this is our set of ideas. But again, I think it's a distinction without a difference or whatever the phrase is. It doesn't matter. We're still trying to get people interested in something, get them in the door, and then we can secure them later.
To go along with what Greg said, too, is like when nations go into alliances with each other, you know, like America does not go to Great Britain and say, okay, we have to agree 100% on every point before we can work together. I mean, they work out a compromise recognizing that they're pursuing different interests. And that's kind of how I see the alt-light and the alt-right. I mean, yes, we realize that we don't agree with these people 100%, but we can still advocate for the fact that we don't think miscegenation is a good idea or a wise choice, yet still be willing to work with people who either are or have in the past engaged in this sort of behavior. And of course, also there's the saying, he who is without sin, throw the first stone. And I mean, everybody changes. So the fact that somebody made a mistake at some point in the past doesn't mean that they're therefore tarnished for life, at least in my view.
Well, yeah, it's worth saying that a lot of the men in the alt-right, lots of prominent men, have a history of race mixing themselves. So again, you know, and I know it's different with women. I know it pisses men off more. I understand that. But nevertheless, the principle is there. Why castigate and attack a woman for this? And especially when it's one who's so useful to. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I completely agree. And one of the things that is kind of astonishing about this whole debate is something that I'm going to call in a little article I'm working on, MGTOW Marxism. And what MGTOW Marxism just refers to is this kind of reductionist assumption that a lot of these Manosphereian types have, that everything is about sex and about strategies for securing sex and about signaling to potential mates and so forth. And they harp on this so consistently that you look at it and you think, God, well, this is not the kind of person that I would like to introduce to my mother or my sister or my daughter or my niece. You can't be friends with somebody like this, right? If they really think that the only relationship any man can have with a woman and the only attitude that a man can take to something connected with women, right, is the model of the guy on the make, right, who's trying to pick up some bombed chick in a bar. That's so stupid, but that's what they do. They have this total reductionism of all motives. And I thought the Golden One in one of his recent videos made an excellent point. He said, this in itself is totally degenerate. Men should be trying to seduce one woman, right? Or two or three. But they shouldn't model their entire relationship with the rest of the world on this seduction. And then there are people in our movement who basically the only thing they know about social psychology is what they learned from pickup artist sites. And so they'll even try this on men. I remember years ago, this really goofy character whom I shall not name in the Bay Area, who is involved in our scene, was meeting with me, and I realized that he was negging me. And as soon as I realized that he was negging me, like, you know, just trying to put me off balance and stuff like that, I thought, does he think I'm some dumb chick, some dumb bitch? You know, don't treat men in the movement like dumb bitches, right, by negging them. But that's what he was doing, and it was so insulting to me when I saw through that I completely lost all respect for this guy. It was gone. And so one of the things that you get with this MGTOW Marxism is you get things like, well, the people who defend women against unproductive attacks are white knights, or they are engaged in an ineffective way of picking up women, right? They're just trying to curry favor with Lauren Southern because they're beta orbiters, right? And so forth. They want to say that it's all about picking up women, and therefore the only choice that you have in attitudes on these things are the effective and the ineffective ones. And the ineffective ones are all the ones that smack of reason and logic and good behavior, and the effective ones are supposedly being, you know, arrogant assholes, because women supposedly like arrogant assholes, right? And it's like, well, I can't think of an attitude that would be better calibrated to totally destroy all standards of discourse in a political movement than the idea that the only way to be powerful and attractive is to be an arrogant asshole. And I mean, you can be an arrogant asshole and have good arguments, but they don't even, you know, care about that, it seems, right? So this has been very, very instructive to me, though, because I realize, and this has really come together in a lot of different forums over this year, is that, you know, a lot of the people in the alt-right, they don't have any education. They really don't have any education, and they don't. This is like their whole culture. And the trouble is that you can't do brain surgery with garden implements. And a lot of the conceptual implements that we have in this online scene are very crude. They're like stone axes, right? So you know, now if people disagree with you on anything, you're a cuck, right? Or if you think,
it's ridiculous.
Yeah, if you think that maybe the white Sharia meme is a bit extreme and probably not the best way of packaging, say, normal, healthy gender relations, which we do want, then you're engaged in white knighting, and you're obviously trying to pick up girls by being a nice guy, and that's not going to work. Nice guys finish last, or you're a feminist, or whatever. These analytical tools are too crude and dumb to capture what's going on. And so what you get is you get these internet lynch mobs armed with stone axes, right? Trying to have political discourse, and thinking that the most arrogant asshole is the sexiest one, and that's going to win. Well, it's just a recipe for disaster. And, you know, the kinds of people who they hear about this, or they're a little bit concerned with, like, rape gangs in Sweden, or, the recent bomb, botched bombing in New York, or whatever brings them to our sphere, and then they stumble in on this, I'm sorry, they're just going to flee. And we have to start thinking about this. You know, we're really becoming
exactly
a repugnant community of people.
This is the trouble. You know, that you can do stuff like that when you're a subculture and you don't intend it to ever go anywhere,
right?
You
exactly.
don't want it. Yeah. But you cannot do that when you have an opportunity for greatness, and we do.
We do. Yeah.
Well, the problem is that so many these people, I feel like they can't really get beyond that because they've been in the subculture for so long, and they've only listen. Oh, and they only hear from people who they already agree with. I mean, especially, you know, when you spend your time. I mean, you know, I've experienced this myself. When you spend a lot of time absorbed in social media, it does have a tendency to become an echo chamber. Definitely. And then I can see why people really thought that, oh, we were the ones who elected Trump because that's what everyone was telling each other within the movement. But unfortunately, when we went out into the wider world, we found out that, you know, it was a bit more complicated than that.
Right.
Yeah.
There's another factor here that I talk about in an essay called Honorable Defeatists, which I believe is in my book, In Defense of Prejudice. And basically, what I try to understand in this essay is, why do people engage in self-defeating behavior, for instance, in personal relationships or in politics? And the theory that I came up with that I think explains a lot of this behavior is this. If people deep down inside feel like they're doomed to lose, then what they will do is they will try and seize control of the disaster, right? they feel like they're going to die. They feel like they're going to fail. And if they're going to fail, if they're going to crash and burn or whatever, they have to at least... They can at least salvage some sense of self-worth and agency by taking control of the process and failing hard. And how do they fail hard? They fail hard on principle. So they find some pretext, some principle that they will push into absolute status. And then, you know, they can break a relationship off, or they can break off relations with people in the movement or whatever. And they can feel good about themselves. And so because they feel on some deep level they're doomed to failure, they will come up with moralistic pretexts that will ensure failure, but allow them to feel good about themselves, to feel superior, to feel principled. There's a lot of that in what people call, you know, autism, about principles in this movement. And I do think that when people actually get their heads around the fact that we can win, that we can change the world for the better, then they can maybe get beyond this, you know, principled failurism, this honorable defeatism. And yes. I think that, you know, it's a bit of therapy that they need to go through. But we really can win this, folks. And therefore, if you feel the need to crash this thing with no survivors, just so you can feel like you're in control, that's the wrong attitude. You need to be more pragmatic. You need to think in terms of the possibility of actually winning. If winning is a real possibility in your mind, if you can imagine the victory, that's the first step to actually achieving it. And I think a lot of us have been so beaten down that we don't have the ability to actually imagine victory yet. But more of us are getting that way. More of us are coming to it that way.
Yeah. I also think that this year has been just quite demoralizing in general, and there's this awareness of a lack of direction. And so that could engender the same syndrome. Let's crash this with no survivors, but at least we'll fuck up in some moralistic manner. You know?
Yeah.
And I also, another way of putting it is that, and I made a video early on, very early on, about subculture and how people can start to fetishize being in a subculture, and anything would be better than being mainstream. It's a sort of adolescent thing, but it can creep up on you. It's insidious. It can happen as an adult. And I think that might well have happened with a lot of people in the alt-right. The prospect of going mainstream is intimidating. It's like when you leave high school and you go to university. You know it's going to be a big new world, and it is intimidating. And yeah, be intimidated. But at least when we take this step into the mainstream, we will have each other. We won't be all of us doing this alone. We will have each other. But we won't have each other if we're fighting each other and, you know, getting lost in paranoia, vendettas, and splits. So just think about what it is that you want. Can you imagine this movement going mainstream? And if you can, then imagine the condition in which you want it to go mainstream. such that it will have success in that wider arena. And I would say that the condition in which he wants it to go mainstream is one with solidarity and predictability and well-balanced people. Now, you might not be a well-balanced person because a lot of people who get into fringe politics are not. But that doesn't mean that you should fear the arrival of well-balanced people, because they will, you know, they might change the thing, your baby, they might change this thing that you've been involved in for years, but that's for the better, and you have to let that happen.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote this essay, it's in my book, Truth, Justice, and a Nice White Country. It's called The Smartest Guy in the Room. And the basic point that I made there is that you never want to be the smartest person in the room. You always want to have access to people who know more than you do, or who are smarter than you, because that's how you become stronger. And we need to build a movement that is constantly trying to bring in better and better people. And that means that we have to accept that we're going to be eclipsed. And I want to be eclipsed. I want to feel like the dumbest person in the room eventually, because then I would know that the movement is really going somewhere, right? And so, unfortunately, there are a lot of people who get involved in this who would fight tooth and nail against that because they don't want anybody to outstage them, outshine them. And, you know, that's the wrong motive. That's the person who wants to be the Führer of some little groupuscule, right? But what we all need to do is we all need to think of a movement that will constantly better itself and improve until it really is capable of being the ruling elite of the white world. Because elites beat elites. We're ruled by a hostile elite, and we have to build a counter elite that is organically connected to our people and that is better than the hostile elite. That's the only way that we're going to win.
I agree. Is there anything else that you want to add before we end this? Anyone?
Oh, I think we've covered it pretty well.
We ended up on the Thoughtgate thing, and we've gone on about that for a long time. I think it is worth talking about.
It's symptomatic of a lot of other problems, and so it is a great starting point to delve into those.
Yeah, yeah. But John, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say, you were mentioning in the chat, you were asking who you thought would go white nationalist first, the conservatives or the Swipple liberals. And, well, I one thing I've been criticizing the alt-right for is, you know, for not engaging enough with, well, first of all, with geopolitics, but especially with economics and recognizing, you know, that the form of capitalism we have today is really largely what's driving what's going wrong. And I've seen there seem to be some feelers from the alt-right going out that way, but they haven't really, maybe because many of us don't know a lot about economics, but, you know, I haven't really seen a lot of that type of rhetoric yet. But I think if we could develop it, then we could, you know, become more anti-globalist, more protectionist, and so forth. Maybe that could appeal more to like the Bernie Sanders and Corbyn sort of liberals in our respective countries. But in the end, when I really think about it, I really think that the issue of race and ethnicity, that's a stumbling block that 90% of leftists, or if not more, are never going to get past. So while I think it would be great, like, I don't know if you guys saw this article by Slavoj Žižek a couple of weeks ago, where he actually, the headline was something like, the alt-right should work with Bernie Sanders supporters to defeat capitalism. It was in one of the UK newspapers. And I think he had the right idea, but when I was thinking about it, I really don't see it ever happening, unfortunately, just because of that reason. That's, the left is never going to become, the majority of leftists are never going to open themselves to the idea of that race and ethnicity, especially European race and ethnicity, is something worth preserving. So unfortunately, while I would love to think we could work with them, I think ultimately it's the conservatives that we have a better chance of reaching.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think that might be true. But Michael, you've
only got... Yeah, I just wanted to add, I wouldn't, you know, discount the left entirely as far as, you know, people from whom new, you might get more, who might come around to our way of thinking, because there have been a number of former leftists who, you know, now identify as alt-right. And, you know, I think Slavoj Žižek himself, you know, seeing what's going on in Europe with the migrant crisis, there's this realization that this is something that is going to affect left-wing ideas as well, because you can't have a high-trust society, a socialist society, when there are these racial, you know, racial groups that are taking all the benefit, getting all the, you know, the wealth, just by leeching off of everyone else's work. So I think, you know, I think there are going to be more leftists that come around to our way of thinking.
That was a theory like a year ago when people were talking about the Bernie, what were they called? Bernie Bros? The supporters Bernie of Bernie. Yeah, everyone was predicting, well, not everyone. A lot of people were predicting, including me, that they would get disillusioned. They would get disaffected. And that would make them amenable to another form of idealism, because, of course, they were very idealistic young white people. And so something else that they might get into would be something on the right. And because they already accept the reality of groups, because they spend all their time advocating for various group interests, it would be not a huge stretch for them to get into, well, white identitarianism. And I think that could still happen.
There was a woman from America that we met. I don't know if you met her or not, but I met her in Oslo in July and spent a good deal of time talking to her. She actually was a Bernie Sanders supporter who came over to our way of thinking and was showing up for the Skanza Forum in Oslo. So that was interesting to see. There are real examples of that happening. And I think that we need to have apostles to the Bernie Bros and apostles to the conservatives and apostles to all the different groups out there in the political realm from whom we might or from which we might derive supporters, converts. We need to send these people out. And we should have, therefore, lots of different platforms, lots of different takes on our message and so forth that are accommodated to all these different white groups, because I think there are potential converts in every sector of white society. And because what we're doing is so crucially important, we have to get those converts in every sector of white society. And to do that, we've got to think carefully about, well, how do we create fishers of men, right, who can go out and actually bring those people over. And that means that we're going to have a movement that somehow manages to encompass and weaponize and coordinate the full diversity that exists within white societies so that we can have purchase on all the different white groups and subgroups and interest groups and draw them all in our direction. Then we win.
Yeah,
I agree. And that seems, John, you go. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say that I think that we can do it in individual cases, but I'm skeptical about the idea that we can, you know, sort of co-opt the radical left just because, you know, so much of their rhetoric is centered around the idea that, well, race is a social construct and so forth. But I'm sure there are still some people there who we could get over to our side somehow, or at least be willing to work with us. I hope, anyway.
Yeah. Again, there's the, you know, percentage who are amenable to reason and who will really follow the arguments, you know, go down the rabbit hole and become red-pilled. And then, you know, there's a sizable percentage who won't. You know, culturally speaking, I think, you know, leftists and conservatives are, you know, really come from very different perspectives. I think that intellectual ideas are going to be much more effective at persuading those on the left who are rational. Whereas conservatives, I think it's going to be, you know, just more polarization, and the more that identity politics, you know, manifests themselves, the more there's outrage, you know, black criminality and so on. So, I think we do need to maintain kind of a big tent that appeals to people who come from all walks of life. And if, you know, there's anything that is good about 2017, I think it's kind of was a year where we kind of, you know, cut our teeth on just, you know, what doesn't work, but also the right wing is, you know, it's kind of branching out. You know, we have this thing, you know, we call it Unite the Right. Well, you know, I mean, we're kind of very divided, but that's actually a good thing because it allows this, you know, market style competition for ideas and methods that work. And in the end, we do have the truth on our side. So, yeah, that's you know, my take on this year.
Yeah, thank you. Greg, your last word.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of good points here. I do believe that 2018 will be a better year than 2017, if only because 2017 has been so bad in so many ways. It just couldn't get worse. I guess maybe that's a delusion that might be tested in 2018.
Maybe
I'm inviting you know, nemesis by saying stuff like that. Never ever say no power on earth can stop us now, because then, of course, you get nemesis in the next scene, right? If you're watching a television show or a movie. But anyway, I do think that we're going to have a better year in 2018. I've got lots of great plans. Countercurrents has lots of great plans for 2018 that I think everyone should be watching our front page for. We're going to be rolling out lots of new books and other projects in 2018. So I'm very, very optimistic. Again, objectively speaking, a lot of things are going well for us, but still it feels overall that the tone and direction of the movement has been negative. And I think that, you know, it's purely arbitrary that the new year begins on the 1st of January as opposed to the 1st of June. But that said, I think a lot of people welcome that day, wherever you put it, arbitrarily, because it psychologically makes it easier to shut the door on the past and look forward to the future. And my avatar is Janus, right? Who looks back and looks forward. And I'm looking forward to a much better 2018. I do think that this is a spirit, a season of renewed optimism. You know, the days get shorter and shorter and shorter until the solstice, and then they start getting longer again, and there's more light and more hope. And I think that it's a time to put the past as much as we can behind us, to learn lessons and then put it behind us, and not just to forget things, but to learn from them and go past them and face the new year with renewed optimism, renewed ideas, and renewed commitment, because I do think that we are going to win. We have the strongest force in the universe on our side, namely the universe itself, namely nature itself. So we can't lose, really. But it's going to be very, very tough nonetheless. So the universe is expecting a lot of you in 2018. be of good cheer. I guess that's a good way of ending it, especially for millennial. Be of good cheer.
All right. Well, that was Greg Johnson, John Morgan, and Michael, hold on a second, Michael Polignano of Countercurrents. So thank you to the three of you.
And thanks a lot for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Woz. Yeah, great.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Okay, so that's it for tonight. The next I think, yes, tomorrow night, and it's going to be The Golden One, Kaylin Robertson, Andy Nowicki, and then Faith Goldie. So that's going to be quite a night. And, well, that's it. So thank you to Countercurrents. Thank you to everyone for listening. And I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.